I'm a great believer that character's incredibly valuable and developing characteristics is incredibly valuable, and that we develop the character and the characteristics through challenge. And it's the choices we make when we hit those challenges that really develop our character. So, you know, to become a more resilient person, the choices we make when we fall over and we're face down in the dirt, and we're wondering, do we want to get back up again? This is hard. I'm face down in the dirt. Do I want to get back up and get knocked down again and do it again and again and again? Is it worth it? You know, that thought that we have and the decision we make in that moment when we are face down in the dirt shapes our character. That really dictates whether we become a more resilient person or not.
Hi, I'm Al Fawcett, and this is Infinite Pi Thinking. So let me start by telling you a little bit about what these conversations are all about. I get to talk with remarkable people who share their stories. We discuss their challenges, their experiences, their lessons, their perspectives, and of course what they did and do with them. This is not really a how-to guide, but it is a look inside someone else's world with a chance to see it from their side. I personally don't think there is a one-size-fits-all approach to things. However, we can learn from others and their successes and how it may apply into our lives, both personally and professionally. It might be that you hear something new or things that you've heard before. It could be that it's something that you do or you want to learn about. And along the way, maybe you'll think about things a little differently or in a completely new way. And of course, take some action as a result. So today I'm speaking with Simon Hartley, who's a globally respected sports psychology consultant and performance coach. For more than 20 years, Simon has worked with elite level athletes and sports people, including gold medalists, world record holders, world champions, Olympians, and championship winning teams. In the last 10 years, Simon has applied many of the lessons that he's learned, the principles that he's shared, and the skills that he's developed to business, education, healthcare, and the charity sector. Passionate about helping individuals and organizations to maximize their performance, Simon is focused on helping them work towards becoming world-class in their chosen fields. So I'm sure that you'll see that there is something here for anyone interested in developing their mindset and their approach to their performance, whether personally or professionally. Take a listen and let me know what you think. Simon, welcome to Infinite Pi Thinking.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
It's brilliant. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So, as I said in the introduction, you work with people and organizations and help them to maximize their performance and realize their potential. And you talk about helping them to become world class.
Mm.
So, how do people reach out to you? Do they literally contact you and say, we want to be world class, can you come and help us? Or do they say, we've got a specific problem that you want to focus on? Or could you come in and identify where we can get better? Where does it tend to start with you?
Yeah, a mixture of all of those, to be honest. And it really depends on what their ambition is and where they are. And most of the inquiries come through referrals of one kind or another. So it could be, for example, it could be the agent of an athlete or a sports player who approaches me and says, either my client's struggling, could you help them? They're in a bit of a hole at the moment. Can you help them get out of the hole? Sometimes it will be, I've got a project at the moment that I'm about to kick off with a golfer who's playing at one level on one tour, just below the PGA Tour. And they want to make the step change. And they know actually that they are a talented player. There's no doubt about it. But they're not really maximizing their potential at the moment. They know there's more to get. And actually, you know, some of the projects that I really enjoy, whether it's with an athlete or maybe an entrepreneur who's got a business or a business leader who's got a team or a sports coach who's got a team, they just know that there's more to get. They're just a little bit frustrated. They can see the amount of potential that's there and they know that they're not realizing all of that potential.
And that's a really interesting one because I've got a love-hate relationship with that word, potential, because I think it's phenomenal. I think it's great. But I remember many, many, many years ago when I was a younger man and I had that label on myself, Al, you've got potential.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to take it. I didn't know if that was a good thing because I was capable of more or hang on, is that saying that I'm not doing very well now?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And again, it was a young man's mindset and I was trying to work my way through this. So you mentioned about somebody maybe struggling or it could be the other way that they actually are doing quite well. But like you said, that step change, and I like that language, that perspective of, I know I can do better and I want to do better. So help me, because I can't see what I can do. Because one of the things that when I ask people with regards to their ability to improve, I ask a question of the difference between capability and capacity.
Yeah.
So have you got the capacity to do more is different to have you got the capability to do more? Because sometimes we lock ourselves down with, I'm working as hard as I can.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean you're not capable of more. It just means you haven't got the capacity to work any harder. So maybe we need to change what you're working on.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that the type of things that you look at and unpick as to, okay, so when we say step change, what are we trying to change?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that word potential, I think you're right. It's like many words, it's sort of been overused in the wrong context, if you know what I mean. And we've really lost a core understanding of what it means. I'm writing a book at the moment, and unlike the first eight, this is a fictional book. It's a massive, massive challenge for me. And I actually sent the book out to a few kind of close friends and contacts to get some feedback, you know, a bit of sort of beta testing, as it were. And I've taken this book to the highest level, the highest point that I can at the moment with my current capability as a fictional writer.
Right.
And it's probably about a 7 out of 10. It's not bad. It's not terrible. I mean, this is the seventh draft of it. So I mean, right. It started off being terrible. It's not terrible anymore. I've kind of got it that far. But interestingly, that a lot of the feedback I've had says this book's got so much potential. And essentially what they're saying is we can see glimmers of greatness in it. You know, there are little bits that are really great, but it's not great across the board.
Yeah.
And actually, when I look at athletes sometimes and you know, the golfer that I just described, there are elements of their game that are just superb. And some days, on some occasions, they can be wonderful. But they're not wonderful all the time. They're not wonderful consistently. And if you look at my 74,000 words of my book, there are little phrases here and there, little paragraphs, bits of chapters that are really, really good, and others that sort of at the moment let it down, for want of a better phrase.
Right.
So it's got that potential. And I think lots of people are in a position where actually some of what they do is really, really good. It shows how good they could be. But at the moment, it's not all quite there yet.
Right.
So that's part of how we kind of realize our potential. I think that distinction between capability and capacity is also a really, really good one to draw, because a couple of years ago, I was working with a senior executive in a business, and this business was looking to go through a succession planning exercise to find their new MD. So they'd identified in the boardroom, there were probably three or four people who were potential managing director candidates, but they didn't really know which one was going to be the front runner. And I'm a believer on letting merit speak. So let's work with them all. And after a while, we will see who on merit looks like they're starting to lead the pack. And at that point, we can put a little bit more work into them and hopefully get them across the line and give them the capability that they need. And the managing director at the time, we were looking at one of the candidates, the operations director, said, I don't know whether she's got the ability for strategic thinking. And I said, well, actually, we've got to differentiate these. She might be capable of it, but at the moment, she's so bogged down in the day-to-day stuff she's doing, she hasn't got the capacity for it. And until we liberate her headspace and get her out of the day-to-day and make sure that her team can do all of that without her, until we do that, she may have the capability, but she's not able to employ it. So we won't know until we create the capacity for it. And when we did, when we liberated her headspace, she's eminently capable of strategic thinking. In fact, she demonstrated a lot of it, and she is now the managing director of that business. So yeah, I think you're right. You have to understand the component parts, really, to know how to unlock that potential, quote unquote.
I think that's fantastic. I think there's some really great stuff in there. And with regards to that individual, the easiest thing in the world is to look at that person. But again, it's about the environment in which they're in. Because if she felt the need for her to have to be at the tactical level because of the team around her and their abilities, it's about putting them in a different environment and saying, okay, how would they live up to that as well? But you said at the beginning, you're on the seventh draft of your book. And with the first one, it started off being terrible. And it's seeing those glimmers of hope, those glimmers of quality, as you say, that then says, but this is how I can make it better, is where the potential comes. Because if it just was terrible and everybody went, you should stop, then obviously it's a different conversation. But many people will look at that first draft themselves, beat themselves up, go, that's terrible, and then never take it to a second draft. And then they never actually tap that potential and see how far they can take it. But what if that first draft had been 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 straight away? So if you think about people's performance, who sometimes they just are natural with certain things, is there a tendency or is there a danger from a psychological point of view that, well, I can do this now, I'm good at this, and therefore they don't push themselves on to that 9, that 10, that how far they could actually get?
Actually, it's something that I saw even in my first few years of working in sports psychology. When I came out of university, I worked with groups of elite athletes. And one of the tendencies that I saw is that those who found it naturally easy and were naturally quite good at it didn't work as hard on it. And one of the athletes that I worked with for, I think as an athlete and sports psychologist, we worked together for about 7 years. So it took him through a real journey from being absolutely nowhere in the world, actually not really on the GB radar, to finishing as a double Olympian and a double Commonwealth champion and seventh fastest in history. And he describes, interestingly, that because he wasn't a talented athlete in the classic sense of the word, he wasn't naturally gifted, he didn't naturally find it easy, he had to, in his words, discover the roadmap. And he knew every step along the journey. Now, that's something that if you are naturally talented and if you do find it naturally easy and, you know, you just kind of dive in the pool and you're the first one to the finish, you don't necessarily learn all those steps. And what you don't learn along the way sometimes is the characteristics. You don't develop the characteristics in yourself that are really critical. I mean, if you look at those people who have become champions, you know, sort of, and not necessarily a champion once, but time after time after time, those people who were successful for years on years, you know, the likes of Tom Brady in the NFL, he's an example of a guy who was not naturally talented. You know, he was selected in the 17th round of the draft. He almost didn't pass his physical tests in the combine because he was too small, too weak, too slow, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And yet he's become probably the greatest player the NFL has ever seen. He's somebody who had to work at it. He developed the characteristics, you know, it was... I'm a great believer that character's incredibly valuable and developing characteristics is incredibly valuable, and that we develop the character and the characteristics through challenge. And it's the choices we make when we hit those challenges that really develop our character. So, you know, to become a more resilient person, the choices we make when we fall over and we're face down in the dirt and we're wondering, do we want to get back up again? This is hard. I'm face down in the dirt. Do I want to get back up and get knocked down again and do it again and again and again? Is it worth it? You know, that thought that we have and the decision we make in that moment when we are face down in the dirt shapes our character. That really dictates whether we become a more resilient person or not.
Excellent. So let me put a little scenario to you. Somebody picks up the phone and says, hey, I've heard great things about you. I'd like you to come and work with me or my athlete or my team or in my organization. I need to work on some things. And I think we have the ability, the potential to be much better than what we are. We're doing okay.
Yeah.
I think we can do much better. And you have this first conversation and no doubt you have a process and you ask them some questions and you're just sort of getting a sense of what they want to work on. And in a sense, how committed to this are they? If they go to, I see that you aspire to help people to become world class, we want that. And they say all the right things at the start. And then you start to ask the questions. So what does world class look like to you? And then you start putting some things to them and you start hearing phrases like, well, we haven't really got the time for that. And yeah, it's all very well, but some of our competition are. And you start hearing those, what I call going from the aha moments, wow, great potential, we got this great idea, whatever, to the ah, yeah, but moments, where all the reasons why not start to come through. Is that an alarm bell for you? Or is that something that you start to work on with them by catching them doing that and saying, can I just replay some things back to you?
Yeah, certainly it's an alarm bell. And from my point of view, how they respond to that realization is critical. So one of the things that I typically do, if I'm working with a squad of junior international athletes, you know, so there might be junior GB squad, for example, who are potential future Olympians, I'll often do something that's quite atypical in my line of work. I'll walk into the room and I'll say something like, hands up if you want to be a world champion. And as you can imagine, all these hands go up in the air, there's hands everywhere. And then I say something that probably surprises them. I say, I don't believe you. And that you can see their faces contorting. Why don't you believe us? What are you saying that for? And shouldn't you be the one who's kind of inspiring us and injecting us with positivity and all that sort of stuff? And I say, I'll tell you what the reason I don't believe you is because I just watched you lot train this morning and you don't look like world champions in the making. Because you, for example, I saw you when the coach was giving you some feedback, you were chatting to your mate. You didn't hear a word of it. I also heard the coach say, you need to go absolutely 100% full out, give it everything. And you did about 90-odd%. And the coach said, you need to work, you know, if they're a swimmer in the pool, for example, you need to push it all the way into the wall. And you drifted from about 10 meters out. So there's a difference between saying you want to be a world champion and doing what it takes. Equally, you know, if we weren't even watching you in training, if we had a like a spy on the wall camera, you know, fly on the wall type camera, and we watched you making choices in life, would we see you eating burgers and drinking fizzy drinks or not? Would we see you up on your PlayStation until 2 a.m. or getting to bed early to get a good night's sleep to be in training fresh the next morning? All of those things add up. And actually, if you want to be a world champion, you'd have to make different choices and do different things. So do you really want to be a world champion is the question, or do you just like the sound of it?
That's the thing, isn't it? It's the old story of somebody goes up to a guitarist in a famous band and says, I love what you do. I'd really love to be a guitarist in a band like you. And the guitarist turns around and says, no, you like the idea of doing it, because if you really wanted to be a guitarist in the band, you would have practiced 6, 7, 8 hours a day like I did at 15 until my fingers bled, knowing that this is all I ever wanted to be and what I wanted to do. Yeah. So there's a difference between I would love to do that and I like the idea of doing that. Mm. So yeah, and what you just said there is a classic example of that. A couple of bits that stood out for me in what you said, their expectation that you were going to come in and inject them with positivity. Because obviously you're the sports psychologist guy, right? So surely you're there to get their mind right. And that's all about, if not you, who, if not now, when, and all these sort of lovely phrases that get trotted out. But it's that reality check is what I took from what you said. It's like, okay, let's baseline this against where we want to be or where we think we could get to. Mm. So do you have a process that does that? Are you a big goal setter with people? Do you get them to, let's break down what world-class actually looks like and feels like, rather than it just being a label on a wall or a note in a pad, I want to be world-class. What does that look like and what do I need to do to achieve that? Is that your process?
Yeah, kind of. I've got a sort of a weird, particularly for somebody in my line of work, quite a weird approach to goal setting. Okay. I think that simultaneously it's completely useless and really useful. And the useless bit usually is people mindlessly kind of setting an outcome goal without understanding the process behind it and what they need to do to get there. I'm a huge advocate of focusing on the processes, understanding the processes, particularly the critical processes, the processes that have the biggest impact. One of my little phrases that I often trot out, particularly when I'm working with sports teams, is the little things are the big things. So we need to get the little things right, but there are some little things that have a big impact and a bigger impact than others. So what are those? What are the critical things that we need to do consistently well, time after time after time after time? And how do we make sure we get better and better and better and better at them day on day on day on day? Because you know, if we said today that we were a 7, 8 out of 10 or whatever it is, how do we make sure that tomorrow we can be better than that? And the day after that, we can be better again. And the day after that, we can be better again. There are a couple of little phrases that I've come to understand encapsulate the way that world-class people think. Better today than yesterday, better tomorrow than today is one of them. And it, critically, it's what do I have to do in order to be better tomorrow than I am today? You know, it's a really, really simple understanding, but it's also incredibly rare. I mean, I've just written an article, which I posted on my blog, and it's called The Guaranteed Path to Success. What I don't tell people is that the long title is The Long, Desperately Boring, Monotonous, Tedious Path to Success. And that actually, if you genuinely want it, there's an awful lot of desperately boring, tedious, monotonous. Yeah, if you talk to swimmers, they will talk about hours of just staring at the black line on the bottom of the pool. If you talk to golfers, they'll talk about hitting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of balls. Now, one of the differences actually between a golfer who hits hundreds of balls and a golfer who successfully hits hundreds of balls is that one does it with purpose. They don't just mindlessly smash 100 balls off of a tee. But they do have to still hit the hundreds and hundreds of balls. And actually, it's if you wanted to just switch your mind off and smash 100 balls mindlessly off the tee, you could kind of do it and it would have like almost like a cathartic therapeutic effect. It would be quite relaxing. If you do it purposefully, it's exhausting. You know, mentally, it's exhausting.
So tell me about purposefully, because I agree with you 100%. But for people listening, doing it with purpose. So what's the difference in your mind and why is it tiring? Because I do the same with coaching. So coaching to me isn't about just having a cozy chat. It's about a conversation with purpose. By the end of this, you're going to walk away and be able to tell me, what have you got now that you didn't have at the beginning of this conversation? And that's the type of things that we'll work through. So again, that practice with purpose. What sort of things, whether it be a golfer hitting a golf ball or somebody within an organization ready to do a presentation or whatever it might be, what do we mean by with purpose?
So if it was a golfer standing over, let's say they're on the driving range and they've got their, you know, 3 wood or whatever it is out and they're hitting balls. One golfer will just try and smash the ball. And what they're kind of looking for is it goes nice and high and long and straight. With another, if you say, what are we trying to do with this? Let's just take a course. You're standing on the opening tee, you know, first hole on the course. What have you got in front of you? Well, I've got a fairway, right? How wide is it? Let's aim for the middle third of that fairway. Is it straight out in front of you? No. It bends off to the left. Okay, so what are you going to need? A fade, a draw, or whatever? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. And when do you need the ball to do that? Okay, I need a late fade. Right, okay. So let's get a ball to do that. On our imaginary fairway, where did it land? Did it land right in the middle of the fairway? Did it land off to the side? Let's cut the fairway into thirds. Did it land middle third, right third, left third? Oh, yeah, okay. Let's try and get it middle third of the fairway then, shall we? Because it gives us more margin for error. And if the wind was blowing or whatever, or if it was wet, or you know, at least we've got the margin for error. So now we start to practice with real purpose. Now that ball, just hitting that ball takes an awful lot more focus and it's more deliberate, it's more intentional. And you could hit 10 balls like that and it would be more mentally taxing than hitting 100 if you were mindlessly smashing them.
Yeah. And the muscle memory and all those sort of bits and pieces that comes with that, because the next time that person is on that first tee with that type of thing in front of them, they go through that mental process. What about, so here's the classic question. And again, it tends to apply in sport, but you can see the parallels and the links into other environments. The performance under pressure. So whether it be, and I've been lucky enough to speak to some elite performers on this show, and I spoke with Michael Leiner, rugby World Cup winner, and obviously he was a place kicker, and we talked about that requirement, if you like, of your heart rate's got up to 160 beats a minute, running down the field, scoring a try, or supporting somebody who has, and then all of a sudden, within about 30 seconds to a minute, you've got to be putting a ball down, calming yourself, and trying to kick it over the post for the points after. He talked about getting to a point where he had a slow motion button in his mind, where he could flick a switch and things would go into slow motion for him and calm down. Is that something that you work with people? So we see that people can practice penalties time and time again, but when it comes to there's 60,000 people in a crowd screaming at you, it's to win the World Cup. How do we go through that mental approach to make sure that our thinking is aligned to our motor actions, as it were?
Yeah. As you can imagine, this is something that it's not just a challenge for sports people. You know, this is a challenge for somebody delivering a presentation or standing up on stage or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And from my point of view, the principles are exactly the same. So one of them is to understand what the job really is and what it isn't. So you talked about penalty kicks. One of the examples I give, actually, and I don't know whether you can remember this, back a few years ago, there was a guy called Roberto Baggio, who was the best player in the world at the time. And he was taking the final penalty, you know, in the penalty shootout, in the World Cup final. He's the best player in the world, and yet he manages to kind of hit Rose Ed, kind of miss the whole stadium almost. He missed it by that much. And you kind of think, how does the best player in the world go from being able to almost put the ball wherever he wants to skying this? And then you start thinking about, well, what did he imagine the job was? Did he understand that the job was actually just to put the ball into an 8x24-foot rectangle? And actually, there's probably a piece of that 8x24-foot rectangle that he's really aiming at. It might be top corner, bottom corner, whatever. Is that what he thinks the job is? Or does he think the job is to win the World Cup, avoid the criticism? Imagine if he thinks that his job is to avoid that scenario where he walks off the plane and he gets pelted with tomatoes by the Italian public. You know, if he starts to imagine all of those bars in Italy and people in their homes, millions of them, kneeling down in front of their TVs with their, you know, praying and think, oh, what the paper's going to write if I miss it. If his head's full of all that stuff, he's not focused on the job in hand. So understanding what the job is and isn't is critical. I like to explain things by drawing massive distinctions between things, you know, going to the extremes. So there's a golfer standing over a 2-foot putt. Any day of the week, he's going to do 100 out of 100 almost, you know, 99 plus out of 100, 2-foot putts. It's not a difficult skill. What if you walked up to the golfer and you said, oh, by the way, if you miss, we're going to hit this big red button and detonate the earth and everybody dies. If that golfer thinks his job is to put the ball in the hole from 2 foot, there's a good chance he'll do it. If he thinks his job is to save the world, might be a different prospect. And he's likely to feel the pressure.
Yeah. As you were describing the penalty, I can hear the commentators in my head saying things like, the country's hopes rest on him converting this kick. Mm-hmm. And some players will potentially be playing that script in their head.
Yeah,
the country's hopes rest on me converting this kick rather than I need to put it in that bottom right-hand corner. Mm. So, okay, so that makes sense. And again, I like that storytelling and how the impact of that. But let's say, I mean, that's a one-off, the penalty kick, but you've mentioned golfers a few times. So I go back a number of years as well, and I think of Greg Norman and his complete collapse in the last half of a major tournament. And it was just incredible to see this massive swing. What can somebody do in those environments where they start to see it going the wrong way? Is there something they can do to halt, check, and reset to be able to get that back on track rather than to just see it spiral down the plug hole?
Yeah, and this really depends on your sort of your approach to these things. I'm a great believer that there are the best strategies are personal strategies. And there are some things that work for some people and some things that work for others. And some of the little kind of tricks people find very difficult to use, the tricks and techniques, whether it's breathing techniques or whatever, they'll still find it difficult to do. Mm-hmm. I'm a bigger believer in understanding the principles and being able to manage those principles so that you don't get to that position of needing the tricks. One of the ways that I understand pressure, which is very, very different from a lot of people, and if you put 100 sports psychs in a room, I think I would probably be in the vast minority of people that think this way. My understanding of pressure is that it can only be experienced in one way, and that's through your imagination.
Right.
You know, you can only imagine pressure. And here's why I say that. So when we feel pressure, it's usually because we've painted some pictures in the future. They're outcomes. We've got the outcome we desperately want and the outcome we desperately don't want. And they're in the future. So, and because they're outcomes, they're uncertain. You know, we can't control them. They're uncertain. They're in the future. We don't know what's going to happen. But the thing is, what we do is we tie ourselves emotionally to one of these two outcomes. So at the sort of base level, when we tie our emotions to it, we say, I'll be happy if we get this one, and I'll be really upset if we get that one. So now we've added an emotional dimension to it. There's a feeling to it. And we might start to feel some angst because it's in the future and we can't control it, but we definitely want one and we definitely don't want the other one. We could go a stage further, and some people do, and they tie their self-worth to it. So I will feel good about myself if we get this one, and I'll feel bad about myself if we get that one. You know, so if we win, if I score, whatever, I'll feel good about myself. If we don't, I'll feel bad about myself. Some people go even further, and they tie their identity to it. So I'll see myself as a success and think of myself as a success and believe I'm a success if we get this outcome. And I'll believe myself as a failure. I'll see myself as a failure. I'll feel it like a failure if we get that one. And now there's going to be real angst because we've tied something even more powerful to it.
Yeah.
And because it's in the future, it has to be imaginary. Because as a human being, there's no other way to experience the future. We've got three basic ways of experiencing life. So the future is through our imagination. The past is through our memory, which is usually also a product of imagination. It's
a bit of a story. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. And the present is through our senses and thoughts and perspectives. So that's all we've got. And if we understand it in that way, if we're feeling some angst, it's because we're imagining it. So we can ask ourselves a question. Why am I feeling the angst? Well, if I'm tying my identity to this thing, and saying, I'll feel like a success. I'll see myself as a success if we get that one, and a failure if I get that one. It tells me that I'm relying on this to feed my self-worth. So the question is, if I had a solid sense of self-worth, would I need this outcome? Or do I already feel good enough, whether the ball goes in the hole or not?
Right. So again, if we break it down into what my interpretation of that, and correct me if I've got this wrong or interpreted this wrong. But again, you've got that situation where a lot of people will work on absolutes on outcome. So you can hear language patterns. Again, you see somebody step up, take a penalty, and you hear the external commentator, the literal commentator, but you can hear the internal commentator goes, he never misses shots like this. Or she always gets these in, or whatever it might be. So it becomes this absolute. Now, you can use that as a driver. You can use that as a confidence builder initially, until the first time it doesn't happen. Because all of a sudden, the word never has gone forever. So is always. So you are now the person who is not the person who never misses or always gets. So that's quite interesting. But the bit that you got to at the end there as well is whether it's a confidence driver, it's a thing that drives you because I'm great at this. The focus is on, again, all the way down to what is the job at hand? What is the process that I need to go through in order to maximize my potential of achieving the result that I'm looking for? And that's where the goal comes. So the goal is, I want to get this in the hole. Do I control whether it goes in the hole or not? Only on the way that I do the bits that I can physically do over here. Yeah. But the big element in relation to what you were saying that I heard was, in a sense, it's managing your state. It's managing the emotional connection that you have to this and all the stories we tell ourselves. So again, my principle is always, if I improve your thinking, I'll improve your performance. And the thinking that we're talking about here is, okay, what have you got control of? What are you focusing on? And sort of let go of all that other stuff. So when it comes back to the goal setting thing that we started this conversation with, I'm a believer in dream big, set small goals. So I want to go to the Olympics and win the gold. You know, some people will say, why would I want to go to the Olympics not expecting or trying to win gold? Well, great, but one person in the world is going to win that, you know? So dream big, but let's now take it down to, so what do we need to do today to move us on that path, to set us up to be in the best possible shape to do that?
Yeah. And bizarrely, I wrote a little book which was published in 2013 called Could I Do That? And it was all about my own personal experiences of taking on enormous challenges. I wanted to know, how do people take on those seemingly impossible challenges? Ones that when they start out, they probably don't believe themselves that they can do it. They've never done anything like that before. Mm-hmm. So in combination, I studied some people who had taken on impossible, seemingly impossible challenges, and set some for myself so that I could understand the kind of internal conversation, the conversation between your ears, you know, how to deal with those doubts when they flood in, all that sort of stuff. And one of the things I noticed during the book, I talked about, you know, I said goals are simultaneously really useful and completely useless. I described it by saying that truly successful people don't set smarter goals necessarily. They set dumber goals. Daft, unrealistic, mental, bonkers, extraordinary, ridiculous, you know, those sorts of goals. But actually, I started to realize that in order to achieve the dumber goals, they usually start setting some that have got smart elements in them. So that's the process by which you get to the dumber goal. So yeah, I think there are elements of both of those. Again, for me, it comes back to, let's understand the process. If you want to get there, what do you have to do? And particularly, and I think this is where one of the real differentiators comes in, what would you have to do that most people don't do or won't do? What are those elements? Because really, there's nothing stopping anybody from becoming world-class in a field. I mean, if you're 2'6", you're not likely to become a world-class basketball player. Equally, if you're 7'9", you're not likely to become a world-class jockey. But it doesn't mean you can't become world-class in something. And if you want to, you've really got to start understanding what you need to do that most people don't or won't do and work into that sort of territory.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. So again, when we talked about earlier about your conversation with somebody, and when you start hearing certain language patterns, you'll hear those people that will do the, but we haven't got the money and we haven't got the time and we haven't got the this and we haven't got that. But when you play it back to them, that will be, I want to achieve this, but we haven't got, but they'll start to break down, okay, So what does that mean? Well, we'll need to find the money. Right. So how do we do that? And they then start to break down those challenges and go, okay, well, we're starting from here and we'll move forward. Mm. If you think about, if you said to a sprinter who wanted to be a world-class and you said, you're going to have to take 3 seconds off of your time, that might come across as overwhelmingly large at the start.
Mm.
But it's like, okay, so where do we start?
Yeah.
You know, let's shave a little bit off and a little bit off. Let's focus on your start and see if we can get a little bit quicker out of the blocks, which is going to shave a bit of time off. Mm-hmm. Let's work on these. And you'll break down the various elements in order to then go, let's not try and tackle 3 seconds as a whole.
Mm.
Let's break it down into the pieces. And do you tend to focus on enhancing strengths, developing weaknesses, or a combination of both? You know, like you said earlier, there's arguments for all of these different bits and there's no one size fits all. But I've heard lots of people will do the thing of don't waste time developing weaknesses, focus on your strengths and enhance those.
Yeah.
Other people will do the no, you need to develop weaknesses because, you know, that's a hole in your game or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And other people say, well, it's a combination of both.
Yeah.
So where do you sit on some of that?
I think to a certain extent, when we start off with either of those two questions, we're probably not starting with the best question. So if it's a sprinter and we need to take 3 seconds off, the question is, what do we have to do that? You know, what's required? That will tell us whether it's a strength that we need to enhance or a weakness that we need to develop. You know, if it's a golfer, we need to put the ball in the hole in fewer shots. So what do we need to do that? You know, it almost answers itself when you do that.
Well, let me give you a little bit of more of a specific example on that. So you just mentioned golfer. So you've got a golfer, you identify that the weakest part of their game is getting out of the bunker, is their bunker shots. Mm-hmm. But their accuracy off the tee is off the charts. They're incredible. So they rarely go in the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
So is it better to continue to focus on, let's keep your accuracy up, let's work on your short game, let's get your putting right and all the rest of it? Or going, well, for those few times that you do go in the bunker, let's make sure that we've improved the percentages on that so that's not the thing that's holding you back. And that, I suppose, is where I'm saying it's like a salesperson turns around and says, I'm great in front of a customer, I'm rubbish with the paperwork. So you can either do one of two things. You can either focus on helping them to get better at the paperwork, or you can turn around and say, you get in front of more customers, we'll get somebody to do the paperwork for you. And there's different ways of playing, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the difference between the golfer and the salesperson in that example is the golfer can't get somebody else to take the shot out of the bunker.
Exactly.
And if they could, if it was a team game like that, you might just say, just stick to driving the ball off the tee really well. The problem is we can't, because the ball might go in the bunker, and it might be because the surface is harder than you expected. It bounces further and it goes in the bunker. The wind blows it, whatever happens, and it ends up in the bunker. Now, there is kind of two elements to it. There's functionally being able to get the ball out of the bunker better. The other one is to feel more confident, to develop your confidence that actually, if the ball goes in the bunker, it's fine because I'm pretty good at that. And for the overall package, you know, that sort of mental package for the player, the ability to know that if the ball goes in the bunker, I'm fine. I just pull out a different club and I play a different shot and it's okay. I don't walk up to it going, oh God, no, it's in the bunker. Because if you're thinking, oh God, no, it's in the bunker, please don't let it be in the bunker, you approach that shot really differently and you're likely therefore to execute it differently.
Yeah.
So to be able to build that confidence in your whole game, I think is a real gift.
And I think that's where the examples that I used can evolve, because you're absolutely right. The difference with the salesperson is that they're a cog in a bigger machine, if you like. They're one part of, so they can break that role down into different bits. Whereas the individual player, whilst the golfer has a team of coaches and caddies, at the end of the day, he's the one swinging the club and taking the shots. So if I was to change the tact slightly and say it's a team sport, football, rugby, whatever it might be, the example would be more like, okay, so defender, great on defending headers and clearing things up, but not great on the ball, not elegant on the ball, not going to be fantastic at cutting through passes and whatever.
Mm.
So again, do we work on it and say your job is literally to do that part of the expectation. You clean up on corners, you line up the defense, you just give it to this guy on the left of you who will do the distribution part of it, and you surround them with other people that are great at their roles. And I suppose what I'm alluding to here is, how do you work on the individual within a team environment? So you might be called in to say, we want team improvement, but a team is made up of a bunch of individuals, right? So how do you work on that? We hear lots of words of culture and all these sort of wonderful things, and they all sort of form part of it. But it's understanding the individuals, it's understanding the team dynamic and what the team expectation, it's understanding what how the manager wants to play, the coach wants to play, and pulling all those pieces together, right?
Absolutely. So one of the sports I think that best emulates this is cricket.
Okay.
So when I worked in cricket for many years, and it doesn't really matter which form, it applies to all forms, but particularly you kind of notice it in T20 cricket. The teams who perform best usually have got a really well-defined game plan. Everybody knows their job within the game plan, and they specifically practice those elements of the job. So that's the core, but things change. So we might turn up and we've selected a team for this particular game, but actually when we arrive, the conditions aren't quite as we expect them to. So everybody needs enough flex in their game plan. They need not one core skill, but a number of skills that they can go to, which they're really confident in. And it doesn't mean that we're going to put our kind of strike bowler to become opening batsman. That's not what it means. It means that that strike bowler can't be a one-trick pony. They've got to be able to have enough flex in their game plan that they can kind of mix it up. And, you know, if you watch some of the great rugby teams, you've got prop forwards who can carry, pass, kick. Now, it doesn't mean that on the training field they spend hours and hours doing goal kicking or anything like that. They don't. They still stick to scrummaging, line outs, you know, kind of rucking, mauling. You know, they stick to the core skills. But on the periphery of that, they work on some of those other skills that make them a really well-rounded, complete player. So it's working, I think, from the core outwards. Make sure you've nailed the core skills. And once we're happy that we've got the core skills, let's work to other skills that could be really, really useful as well. Right. So the prop forward probably won't get as far as drop kicking for goal because he's never likely to do that. But he might start working on a couple of other things that he's not quite so good at the moment, but would really enhance the game.
Yeah. Know your role, be really, really good at it. But how do you make those around you better? If you look at great team players in those sports that you just described, is part of their role is how do I make those around me better and help them to be able to do their job effectively, whether it be by giving them the confidence in knowing that they can trust me to do mine, or by asking great questions or challenging them or pushing them or supporting them in whatever way, shape or form. And it's the same here. And I sit in many, many meetings, I'm sure you do the same, where you see people from different functions, all they're worried about is their element. And that lack of understanding of what are we trying to achieve as a whole strategically? What's my role in it? And how do I help those around me to achieve what they need to do, which will inevitably help me to do my role better in the long run as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that ability to look wider is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote a book about teams called Stronger Together, and as I was writing...
You've written 100 books, haven't you?
Well, 8, yeah. And I studied lots of world-class teams. I studied Red Arrows teams and SAS units and US Navy SEAL teams and a Formula One pit crew and racing yacht crews, all sorts of teams. And one of the things I learned most from the Formula One pit crew is that they have to be able to do two things in tandem really well. One is execute my own job, and the other one is make sure I link in with the people around me. So, first of all, I have to be aware of them. I have to be tuned into them. I have to be watching them and listening to them to know when and how I coordinate. And when I talk to businesses about how to adopt those very simple principles, we talk about the chain of interdependency. I need to do X to enable you to do Y so that somebody else can do Z. You know, how does it all fit together? What does that chain look like? And help everybody understand how they contribute to it. You know, I describe it as understanding all of the size and the shape of all of the cogs in the machine, how they all work together, and that every single one of them is vital. And when we understand that, we can start to work better with people. And we start to think differently about a job or a task, because rather than thinking of my priority or your priority, we start with ours and then figure out how I contribute to it and how you contribute to it. And that changes the difference. And when, you know, if you start to kind of unpiece it, when teams aren't working very well, I describe this as the sort of the engine of teamwork. Mm-hmm. We can almost start to see where the weaker links in the chain are. We can identify where the vulnerable links are sometimes. And really it comes down, it's not one person or another, it's the relationship between them. You know, maybe they don't understand the same thing in the same way. Maybe they don't understand the same priorities or whatever it is. They haven't got the same standards and expectations. There's something in there. Maybe they just don't know each other very well. And then we can start to work on strengthening the links in the chain. And that's like kind of lifting the bonnet of the car and getting in with spanners and screwdrivers to fix the engine. You know, that's how we sort of work on teamwork.
That's brilliant. It made me smile because the amount of coaching conversations that I have that in essence drill down to a relationship. Mm. The challenge is a relationship. It's, well, they're not doing this and I haven't got that from them and they're expecting this from me. And it's like, okay, so there's a relationship issue here in one way, shape, form. We can call it communication, we can call it what, but ultimately there's some form of connection that's not firing in the way that it should. And I think that's fantastic. And again, what can tend to happen in those sort of situations is we think we know better, and therefore we then want to tell that person what they could do or should do. And as a result, that person then goes into defense mode and says, I know what I'm doing. And the relationship deteriorates even further.
Yeah.
So by starting with that overarching strategic thing of what are we all trying to achieve here? Are we all on the same page, facing in the same direction? Now, I'm finding a conversation I'm having with a lot of people is making them realize that they might be looking at the same end goal. We are all trying to achieve this. This is what success looks like to us as an organization, as a team, as a function, as an individual. But we might be all in different parts of the map. So we often hear businesses talk about roadmaps. We might be on a different place on the map. So therefore, the terrain in front of us is different. So our view of the journey to that end goal is different. And we can't understand why other people can't see what we can see, yet we're not seeing it from their perspective as well. And in our current situation with the remote working that we're going through and all the other bits and pieces that tie up with that, it's literal as well as mental. You know, we are literally in different parts of the map and therefore have different challenges and whatever. And it's our ability to ask the question of, so what are you seeing at the moment? Mm. What challenges are you facing? What opportunities do you have? And how do I help you to achieve them? Because it might be one thing that you can do that makes a massive difference. Well, I can get that over to you quicker, yeah. Or I can support you on that, or I can take this problem away from you.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that okay? Is that going to help?
Yeah.
And that type of conversation is going to be a completely different thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it sort of comes down to our willing and willingness to collectively solve the problems. And part of it, I think, is understanding how we can help each other. Part of it's being able to take responsibility. I heard a conversation once between, it was an NFL coach and a quarterback and a wide receiver. And there was a pass that wasn't connected, you know, an incomplete pass. And essentially, if you kind of break it down, the quarterback said to the wide receiver, well, you were in the wrong place. And the wide receiver said, well, you didn't throw the ball very well. And the coach said, well, kind of, you're both right and you're both wrong. It wasn't a great pass and you weren't in the right place, but let's flip it on its head. If instead of saying he made the wrong pass, you say I was standing in the wrong place. And if instead of saying he was in the wrong place, you put your hand up and said, but I didn't pass the ball very well, now you're going to go and fix it. Because whilst it's always his fault or his fault, you're not going to fix it. If you put your hands up and say part of it was me and the other person says the other part was me, now you've got a good chance of fixing it. So off you go. And that was that sort of understanding that if we want to fix this thing, we both need to be engaged in it and solving the problem together. But I think you're right. If you took this to a larger organization or a corporate, you're right. They do have a very different view of the world from their own perspective. And there are very few organizations in my experience who understand and whose people genuinely understand how to make a decision that aligns with where we're trying to go. It's one thing that the military, I think, do brilliantly on the whole. You know, they talk about commander's intent. You know the territory in front of you. You know the terrain. You can see it from your point of view. All we're asking is you can make a decision that takes us towards X. It might be that you need to go left, go backwards, you know, kind of retrace your steps, go round, go under, go over. We don't know because we can't see what's right in front of you. But we're asking everybody to make a decision that takes us towards X. And most organizations are not clear on that. So their people don't know how to make decisions that align to it.
Yeah, and that's a key one, isn't it? So sometimes you have leaders within an organization who have a perception, they have a way of doing things. And then what can happen is they can articulate that very nicely. Right, we need to achieve this. This is how we're going to do it. This is our process. And there's that classic Mike Tyson phrase of everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. And so people go off and they start to implement this plan. And they get the metaphorical punch in the face. Something doesn't happen. Something goes wrong. And rather than being in a position feeling empowered and enabled to make decisions that goes, okay, well, that's not going to work. But the objective was to do this. So I'm going to come at it from this perspective and do it this way.
Yeah.
They retreat and stop and go, well, I can't do anything until he tells me what I need to do or she guides me on what she wants. Because it becomes so leader driven, even though that's not their intention. Because I speak with many leaders, go, I'm really frustrated because some of my guys just will not make a decision. They just don't seem to take the initiative and move on this. They're senior people, but they won't move on this. And they don't see the role that they've played in doing that because, you know, they haven't recognized when they haven't used initiative. They haven't supported them when they did something and it didn't quite go to plan, but they said, look, I see what you were trying to do there, and that's fantastic. Let's work it out and whatever. They step back in and go, right, well, I'll just tell you what to do then. And it becomes this ever decreasing circle because people will literally rock up and go, tell me what you want me to do, boss. And their hands go up and it becomes that physical reaction to it. So there's lots of these different elements, but it's also it's that ability to articulate. So rather than coming to a meeting and feeling you need to defend your position, I've got to get my excuses in first. I've got to get my justifications in first. Right, we didn't have a good week, but it's because of this, 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 and this. And you just spend the whole time justifying what's happened and maybe a little bit about, but what we're going to do this week is, and you start to promise the world. And it goes back to your version of the past, perception of the future thing, rather than, right, here's where we are.
Yeah.
This is what I've got control of. This is what I'm doing. This is the things that we've got some influence over. This is what I need from you. You talked earlier about successful teams and how they all understand role. And what about those scenarios and situations where you see, and again, it's easy to use sports teams as examples of this, but it happens within organizations where you get the superstar and everybody starts to go, oh, if it wasn't for them, this team would be average, or they're lucky to have this particular person or this player. Now, you can see how that can lift a team for a period of time, but slowly but surely that can be corrosive for a team as well if it's not managed effectively. Is that something that you've seen, experienced, and had to work with?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of elements to it. I mean, one of the things that I talk to leaders a lot about is an organization that is what I describe as light on leadership. It's dependent on too few people to have the initiative, spot the problems, spot the opportunities, do something about them, take action, you know, lead on things. And when I describe it, I say it's not the absence of people in the business with the title manager or director or head of or whatever it is, because most organizations have all of that. What they don't genuinely have is leaders. And so, you know, a lot of my work is about developing those leaders and developing the sort of that ability, that thinking ability in them so that they can spot the opportunities, spot the problems, come up with solutions, lead their team to find innovative solutions and work together on these things. And actually, when you do that, it reduces the dependency on the superstar, the, you know, the few, whatever it is within the organization, and gives you far more depth. And actually, you know, I think it's a real sanity check for everybody in the organization. If it was in a sporting example, what happens if X gets injured then? What happens if the superstar gets injured or, you know, they get transferred to another team? Does that mean we're sunk? That's not a great place to be, honestly, if you're thinking like that, because by definition, you are vulnerable and your success kind of hangs on a thread. If you look at the organizations that have sustained success, you know, like the All Blacks or whatever, they do not rely on one person. They have superstars, but actually they deliberately breed a lot of people in that organization who are superstars in their own right. And if they lose one player, they can replace them fairly easily with another. They may not be quite as good in that position. They may not be quite as skillful. But the whole organization is capable of withstanding fluctuations in one or two players because the organization's strong enough. Whether it's a sports team or whether it's a, you know, a business leadership team, one of my roles is to make sure that they've got real depth.
Yeah, I like that. And again, what I like about that is because it becomes aspirational as well then, doesn't it? It becomes, one, I see my role in here, but I can see how that can grow and develop. And this is a great place to be. So I've been doing some succession planning with some organizations recently. And again, it's similar sort of things to what you've been talking about, that it becomes almost like a retention plan as well as a succession plan, because I want to stay here because I can see the opportunities because they're investing in me and my development. But also it becomes aspirational from external. I'd love to join and work with an organization like that. I want to be part of that team because why wouldn't you? And also, sometimes you can even apply that from a customer perspective. If you're reliant on one customer, if that customer all of a sudden found, for whatever reason, there is a better option elsewhere, or you are no longer the most appropriate solution, then your business starts to fail. So that superstar customer can become, we put all our energy and investment and everything behind that, and then all of a sudden that disappears. And the flip side of it about having people aspirationally, we want to work with you because we like your ethos and the way that you work. So these things can apply to lots of different aspects of this. And it's that opportunity for people who are listening to this to sit back. And if they just take one thing from this, picking through a lot of the stuff that we've covered at a relatively high level, I mean, we could have taken one of these subjects and really drilled down into detail, but it's that opportunity. It goes all the way back to what you started with, in essence, to turn around and say, there might be people nodding away as they're listening to this. And they're thinking, yeah, I know this. I know this. But there's a difference between knowing it and doing it. So do you know it and you apply it? Or do you know it at a level and go, I know it, but I don't know it well enough to apply it. So I'm going to go and do some research on some of the things that Simon's been talking about. And I'm going to really understand it and what works in our business and what I need to do. And actually, what is my goal? Do I want to be world class? And if so, what are the things that I need to work on? And to actually pick one or two things and start to apply them. So final question then, I'll flip it right round and I'll sort of turn it back on yourself. So what about yourself? What do you do personally to stay on top of this ever-changing landscape that we're in and focus on your own personal performance development and performance improvement? Obviously, you write books, which seems like challenges you and pushes you on, but what do you do to stay on top of these things?
Yeah, there's a combination of things. I mean, for years and years, I've kind of been explaining that I've been following my curiosity, following my interest. And because I do, I've got tons of questions in my mind. There are some that just don't go away. They're the ones that I just have to go and answer. You know, I've kind of got that insatiable need to go and answer them. And that's really what's led me through writing the books. You know, I've got this question that I need to answer. I'll go away and find the answers. I'll research, I'll study, I'll spend time with the world's best teams or leaders or whatever it is. Sort of understand the principles, you know, really kind of unlock the insights. And when I find things that I think are valuable to me, they're likely to be valuable to a lot of other people, and then I can go and share them. That's part of it. The other part of it is that I've started to really understand the value of character and characteristics. So I've also started to understand that if I want to be successful, I need to develop the characteristics that I've seen in world-class performers. So their tenacity, you know, their ability to just keep going and not give up, their relentless focus, the resilience, the ability to bounce back when you hit setbacks, like when you get negative feedback on a book that you've been working for bloody years on, you know. So I need those characteristics in myself, consistency, you know. So I will deliberately start working on developing them. You know, I want to become a more tenacious, more courageous, whatever it is, person. And I know how now to set myself the challenges and work through developing those.
Brilliant. So there's no point in just reading the books and watching the documentaries and looking at these things and going, they're great, I wish I could be like them. It's actually, so what have I taken from that? How can I apply it into my life and actually start to replicate? I'm a great believer in learn from them. Don't try and copy. learn from them and apply them in your life, because you can copy what somebody does, but you can't copy who they are. Don't try and copy somebody's life. It's too easy to read the books and say, oh, well, this successful person gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Well, this successful person gets up at 11 o'clock in the morning and stays up until 3 o'clock. So you started this conversation with, it's very personal. It's, you know, they're individual. I don't like the one size fits all approach. It's about understanding you, but it's also not just using that as a justification. Ah, yeah, but I don't work like that. It's like, okay, so how do you work? And what do you need to do and apply into your life that's going to make a difference? Simon, it has been a joy and a pleasure. The time has flown by. Really, really appreciate your time today. And all that's left for me to say is thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure being here, and I look forward to doing it again sometime.
So a lot to think about as a result of that conversation. Simon shared some great information covering lots of areas such as goal setting, succession planning, exploring our character and building resilience, the concept of pressure as a manifestation of your imagination, the power of high-performing teams, the chain of interdependency, collaboration, and the willingness to collectively solve problems. If you want to know more about Simon, then make sure you head over to his website, beworldclass.com, where you'll find more details and his content and the exciting things that he's up to. Now, I'll also put all the links in the show notes so you can follow Simon there or on the various social media platforms. As always, I also want to say thanks to you for taking the time to listen and to share these stories with people you feel may enjoy and benefit from them. And to everyone who's taken an extra few minutes to leave a rating and review. I really do appreciate it, and it does help more people to find us and get something out of these conversations. Of course, if you want to, you can always reach out to me via all the socials or at infinitepie.co.uk and let me know what you think, what you've taken from these conversations, and of course, what you're doing as a result. For now, go and do stuff that matters.